Here in New York, there's a similar situation brewing to what is happening in Texas. Similar in that it involves the seizure of homes and farms for corporate use. It's not a road, though. It's a power line, and it's called the New York Regional Interconnect, the NYRI. And though it has not been discussed as a part of the SPP, it would clearly facilitate the importation of electricity from Canada. The NYRI is a Canadian-backed company proposing to construct a 190-mile-long power line from Utica, New York, to New Windsor, that would result in the seizure of homes and farms for its construction. The Energy Act of 2005, passed by Congress, created the National Interest Electric Transmission Corridor, the NIETC. And they are regions in the Northeast and Southwest United States whereby the Federal Electric Regulatory Commission will be granted, quote, backstop authority to allow private corporations the right of eminent domain, that is, forced property sale. This legislation preempts the authority of the states to decide when and where electric transmission facilities will be built. It has been presented as necessary to meet New York energy needs in the future, but a recent assessment by the nonprofit New York Independent System Operators, which oversees the electrical grid, has refuted that claim. There has been massive local opposition up and down the state, as the majority of New York's counties, including Senega, Cayuga, Onondaga, Shenango, Ontario, and Monroe, have been designated areas where these corporate seizures may occur. New York state and federal officials have responded to popular outrage and opposition, notably Congressman Maurice Hinchey, who's been playing a leadership role in mobilizing congressional support to repeal the legislation. He's hosted a number of public meetings, which unfortunately I've not been able to attend and record for you. Once again, I apologize for not covering this issue and promise to remedy that in the future. On October 25th, New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo issued the following statement, quote, "Today, a federal district court judge dismissed a lawsuit by New York Regional Interconnect challenging a state law that protects homeowners from the use of eminent domain by private transmission companies. The judge's decision is a win for homeowners in central New York and across the state. As Attorney General, I will continue to fight for New York's right to make decisions on projects like the NYRI based on our state's environmental and energy needs, not on the desires of private companies or the federal government," close quote. Massive public opposition has badly wounded the NYRI, but community groups warn that though it's down, it's not dead yet. Senators Schumer and Clinton have introduced legislation in the Senate that would give the power back to the state in deciding where and when transmission facilities can be built. Congressmen Arcuri, Hinchey, Hall, and Wolf from New York and Virginia have co-sponsored bills in the House, H.R. 809, 810, and 829, to address the problems with the 2005 Energy Policy Act. This is not an issue that affects only New York. All or most of the states of Pennsylvania, Delaware, New Jersey, Maryland, Virginia, and West Virginia have been included in the corporate seizure zone. An interstate alliance of citizens groups have been formed to fight this collectively. These various groups have put out extensive information that's available for you on the web. Like the SPP, the NYRI transcends party lines as it goes straight to the heart of the issue, whether we decide the direction of our communities or whether we are corporate serfs. One place to begin getting more information is to visit nyri.info, which also has links to many other citizen sites. Our final report in our SPP trilogy is a Mexican perspective that comes to us courtesy of CKUT Radio in Montreal. It was recorded in Mexico City last July. The interviewer is Aaron Lakoff.
So I'm here with Dr. Alejandro Villamar, who works with the Remalc here in Mexico City. So we're going to be talking about the ASPAN, known in English as the SPP, Security and Prosperity Partnership. To begin with, can you just explain to me, in general, what is the ASPAN?
Well, the Security and Prosperity Partnership for North America is a new political model. Is the continuation or the follow to NAFTA. Mm-hmm. It is we underline that it's a new political model because not only now include trade issues, but also add security issues. Mm-hmm. It's a new step from NAFTA. Mm-hmm. But these issues on security are not consulting by the formal democratic institution, including the Congress, but also excluded all the public opinion, is the citizens, the Mexican citizens. Mm-hmm. But not only Mexican citizens. SPP exclude Quebecois, mm-hmm. exclude Canadians, exclude U.S. Citizens, and also Mexico. Mm-hmm. This new political model is the result of the last part of the neoliberal policy or the very weakly Washington consensus. Mm-hmm. As maybe the public know, Washington consensus is failed and is very weak. The new position and the new situation in North America is a very broad opposition to NAFTA, mm-hmm. because the results, even in the United States, not only in Canada and not only in Mexico, are very, very weak. Mm-hmm. The promises are total broken. They promise us, particularly in Mexico, that NAFTA can push us to the first world. But you can to ask any kind of Mexican here, the majority, I say, and the majority can to say you that NAFTA is a terrible fail against the majority of the people. We lost millions and millions of jobs. We lost industries. We lost land. And we have a terrible process of concentration of well-being in a few hands. Even we have in this moment the first or the second multimillionaire in the world.
Mm-hmm. Carlos Slim,
yeah, the owner of many, a very big holding, including communications, including retails, including many industrial branches, and even bank. The one small bank, but it's included. Not only in Mexico, and he have a big concentration of enterprises in Latin America. Mm-hmm. Well, in contrast, we have a terrible income distribution, totally unequal. Mostly of the people in Mexico living with only $2 by day. Mm-hmm. And we have a very high rate of unemployment. And this is the reason why many people looking to go to the United States to work and to obtain better income. Mm-hmm. The big question here is that NAFTA broken all the promises, is now or have now a very low prestige, mm-hmm. no? Even into the Congress. This is one of the reasons why the three amigos, as we know, is Harper, Bush, or now Calderon, mm-hmm. they agree to present SPP, looks like it's an administrative agreement of cooperation. Mm-hmm. Because they are afraid that if they present it, look at it, is if they intend to present this project in a very truly nature, need to pass it through or to present to the Congress for the approval or ratification. And they know that even in Canada or the United States or Mexico, they can't to obtain the approbation. Mm-hmm. It is this kind of project cannot to pass through the Congress. Mm-hmm. The parliamentarians reject any kind of approval in this moment of this kind of project. Mm-hmm. But even in the United States, it's biggest. This is the big question. It's a new political because they intend to pass a new project of totally unequal integration. We even say that it is not integration. It is truly an accession of Mexico and Canada to the interests of the U.S. Mm-hmm.
So you spoke a little bit about NAFTA and how NAFTA has affected the Mexican economy. Of course, what we're looking at with the SPP is a bit of an extension of NAFTA. But I'd like to focus a little bit on the security aspect of the SPP. How do you see the SPP impacting security issues here in Mexico?
Well, one of the biggest issue of SPP is the trinational energetic integration or trinational integration of energy. But is the energy from Canada and energy from Mexico resources? It is to supply and to ensure the security of supply energy to the biggest industrial apparatus of U.S. Mm-hmm. It is the security of U.S. On the other hand, is our insecurity for Canada and for Mexico. Mm-hmm. It is who will we have the control of natural resources from Canada and from Mexico? Not the Canadian nation, not the Canadians, and not the Mexicans. The control of the one of the biggest strategical resources, not only in North America, in the world. Remember that finished the era of cheaper oil. Mm-hmm. And now, in this moment, the price of barrel of oil is jumped. The prospectus, it is the prognosis for the next decades is the barrel of oil will be to increase, even it's possible, the researchers say, is the double of the price of today, mm-hmm. the currently price. No? Mm-hmm. Then what happens when a nation lost the control of on the natural resources? What happens when one nation lost the control of the borders? What happens with the citizens of one nation lost the control of the industrialization, lost one of the biggest tools for development, and it's the worst insecurity for each nation, any kind of nation. For this reason, we say SPP is the biggest threat for our country.
A lot of people are also talking about how the SPP will affect migration in the North American continent because of the changes it's proposing to the borders in Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, talking a lot about regional security. I've even heard the comparison that the SPP will make Mexico, the entire country of Mexico, like the southern border of the U.S. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how the SPP will affect migration and border issues here in Mexico?
Well, maybe many Canadians know that after oil revenues, the second source of revenues, it is foreign foreign value from to Mexico, is from money which the Mexican workers in the United States sent to Mexico. Mm-hmm. It is the last year, the family remittances achieved $23 billion. It's
per year,
and this, well, it is the second source for financing national financing balance for Mexico. SPP don't include any kind of cooperation related with the labor migration. We don't talking about illegal migration. We're talking about the cooperation on labor issues. In this moment, it is in the last years, it's very clear now that some economical activities in the U.S. depend very, very hard from the foreign workers. Mm-hmm. The last year, even in Florida or in Texas or in California, some part of the crops were in the risk to lost because they haven't force of labor to obtain these crops. Mm-hmm. Wow. But also many parts of the services, the more common services, the restaurants, retailers, even buildings, the building industry, depend of the foreign workers. Mm-hmm. The majority of the foreign workers in the United States are Mexicans. Mm-hmm. Well, are a few few Mexican workers in Canada in the agriculture. And also in services, but it's not significant in comparison relation with the United States. SPP, it's a terrible project because the spirit of SPP is to obtain the resources from Canada, from Mexico, but without Mexicans, mm-hmm.
yeah.
without Canadians. This is the big question. Then the consequences, if continue to build a border wall, will be too difficult much more for migrant workers. At the cost of lives for crossing to the, through this desert or in a very hard conditions will be to increase. But they can't stop this kind of migration. But what is the deeply questions for U.S.? They cannot recognize the dependency of foreign force of labor. But they want to use the illegal conditions, which they think that, to use for pressure to down the salaries in the United States. It is, if foreign workers come into the agriculture sector or services or retailers, the owners of these economical units have the opportunity to pay less than the low level is writing. No? For the reason, they intend to obtain the competition of the American economy mm-hmm. through very cheap and unpaid labor. It's extremely unequal, extremely unfair, extremely out of any kind of justice. Mm-hmm. And for the reason, this kind of measure, this kind of project, have a very big limits. Limits also for the U.S. economy. Mm-hmm. What is the other possible impact for Mexico? If the level of family remittances the decline in, to Mexican economy, the financial situation in Mexico will be worse. Mm-hmm. We have an a trade balance in negative numbers. Mm-hmm. We have an capital accounts and balance in deficit. Mm-hmm. And the family remittances, it's a key issue to have a more or less balance in this moment. If reduced the remittances, the consequences will be to increase the difficulties and even can to affect the very weak situation and legitimacy of the Mexican government. It is, what is the advantage for the U.S. to have a very weak neighbors? For this reason, they want to use a military, supposedly military solution to stop the immigration, but also to use the NORTHCOM, the NORTHCOM forces, to protect from, not from terrorists, but to protect the interests of the U.S. transnationals, particularly the oil transnational interests, but also the mining and also other strategic branches of our economies, including these Canada and Mexico.
And speaking of these transnational corporations, I think a lot of the reason why people in these three countries are opposing the SPP is because of the North American Competitiveness Council and 30 companies, 10 from Canada, 10 from the U.S., 10 from Mexico, who are promoting it. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit, do you know much about the North American Competitiveness Council?
Well, as you know, the composition of this NAC, it's only sales from the transnational companies. Mm-hmm. What kind of degree of representativeness have this kind of councils? But they are very powerful people which can do not only dialogue with the with the presidents, no, or primary minister, but also to impose the agenda, to impose agenda linked with their interests, not the interests of each country. Well, the other question is that they have an very archaic concept on competitiveness. Competitiveness, even in the theoretical point of view, not depend of the cheap salaries. Mm-hmm. It depend of many other factors, but particularly the productivity depend of the participation of the citizens, mm-hmm. Workers. Enterprises, governments, scientific techniques, it is the society. The society need to have an ideal to produce much more, but also to distribute the income. It's a myth that the China competitiveness depends only of the very cheap salaries. It's a myth. It's a lie. The income in China increased, very, very important, mm-hmm. but also increased the technical and scientific capabilities. And the more important, they are ruled by very clearly project of country. The NAC intend to impose their very archaic concept of competitiveness based in a very, very in the destruction of institutions, democratic institutions, but also in the destruction of the deal between workers and enterprises. Mm-hmm. Even I remember in this moment that one very important Canadian, intellectual Canadian, he said that SPP is a coup d'etat, mm-hmm. in slow motion. It is the destruction of the institution, and NAC is one of the head of this kind of coup of state, because they intend to represent all the nation, but they represent only their very narrow interest, strongly but narrow, non-represent our nations.
I just have one more question. I'd like you to maybe explain what organizations like the Remalc and other organizations, social movements in Mexico, are doing to inform people in Mexico about the SPP and to oppose it. Like what kind of mobilizations or events, activities are happening?
Remember that the SPP is not transparent. Don't have any kind of accountability. During many months was on a secret deal. Only by the pressure of the citizens in Canada, United States, and Mexico, we opened this kind of Pandora box. No? And we denounce to the public opinion. Well, it is important to underline, because not many people in Canada, Mexico, and United States know in detail what is the nature of SPP. Mm-hmm. But in Mexico, fortunately, we have a very good relationship, particularly with Democratic parliamentarians, with trade unionist, more democratic, with a farmers' organization, in a very good and big movement of farmers, because are very, very threatened. No? Mm-hmm. And also with progressive intellectuals, which are very concerned related. When they know it about SPP, start to do more research about this. Even in this year, we achieved the possibility to present in the commercial TV and to produce two big programs, TV commercial programs, and this was very important for the public opinion. What is the situation in this moment? We presented through the parliamentarians from different political parties. Not only one party. Different, we say here in the technical language, it's a point of agreement. It is a call for the parliamentarians to open to the public opinion what happens with the negotiation of the Mexican government into the SPP. Now, even have in the Congress the resolution to call for a trinational meeting of the parliamentarians from Canada, United States, to discuss what is the democracy and SPP. It is what is the role of the parliamentarians in SPP issue. In the preparation, also the farmers' organization have for the next months. It is start August 8th, but they prepare, it is together with us in general, in a big mobilization in the second week of October. Yeah. This is clear because, as maybe do you know, the January 1st, the next year, will be total open the border for imports of U.S. grains. Mm. And this is the biggest threat for the Mexican farmers, particularly the by dumping for corn and beans, no, and for milk and so on, and the farmers will be to mobilize in different cities in Mexico, and they define it that if the government don't take a measure related with NAFTA and SPP, they will be to consider to blocking the borders, blocking the ports, blocking the different entry points for this kind of commodities. It is a very serious mobilization. At the same time, the trade unions, we expect that in September will be have an important Congress and to take decisions. In this moment in Mexico, we live in a very sensitive political atmosphere, as maybe many people know it in Canada. The new government have a very low degree of credibility, very low degree of legitimacy, because the last election was defined for a few thousand of votes. Many people don't believe that Calderón went in a truly way, no? Well, for the reason, all this kind of mobilization, parliamentarians, farmers, trade unionists, and citizens in general, came to affect the political stability of the government. We expect that the government can to change the current policy. I would like to add one other question, which is not known by the North American citizens. It is citizens from North America. It's best to say that. In one of the one of the 10 groups from the prosperity part of SPP, it is the agriculture, food and agriculture. One of the key issues is the Navy. Navy is the North American biotechnology initiative promoted by the transnationals. The core of Navy is to promote and to impose transgenic products and also nanotechnology products in our three countries. And it is a very big threat to the health of the people, but also a very big threat for the producers. Canada rejected and fighting very hard against GMOs in wheat. We in Mexico fight against, very hard against the GMOs in corn, or corn GMOs. But this agreement of Navy, which is one part of the SPP, it's very important for the consumers. If we don't understood this, we can to pay very, very big price for the health of our child, for the health of the nature. For the reason, I think that it's very important also for the Canadians. It's concrete questions and need to fight against this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Alejandro Villamar, interviewed by Aaron Lakoff of CKUT Radio. A number of state legislatures have passed or are considering anti-SPP resolutions. Some of them are Idaho, Arizona, Illinois, Georgia, Missouri, Montana, Oklahoma, Oregon, South Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, Utah, Virginia, and Washington. We'll conclude the program as a sort of bookend with another reading from the work of philosopher Genevieve Vaughan, Forgiving, a Feminist Critique of Exchange. When we see our planet from space, we see no nations, no borders, no governments. These things and others, like markets, money, laws, and all the other social arrangements we humans have, all these things are just ideas, ideas we have made concrete. Nothing about them is inevitable or unchangeable, and we could, any time we want, base our lives on other ideas. In the section titled Market and Gender, an Altered Reality, Vaughan writes, I'm trying to trace the self-similar patterns of patriarchy in different areas of life so that we can recognize them. Women and other have-nots may feel that if only we had, we would realize our potential, becoming equal to the haves and finally fully human. Thus, we aspire to the rewards of patriarchy and unwittingly help to motivate the system. If we can recognize the patterns, we can use the system for survival while we are changing it, without giving it value, without giving it our hearts. The market is like a language which is evolving from a past into a future state, according to quantitative rather than qualitative value, and having only one word, money. The constraints upon this language derive from the kinds of human relations it is required to mediate, the mutually exclusive relations of private property. Money names the products again and again as values, but because of the exchange mode, which preserves the ego orientation of all, no further mutually inclusive material relations can develop. The human exchangers cannot evolve fully as a community. The market seems normal, given to us by the way things are. It is actually an altered reality. Why, indeed, should human beings allow the naming process to stand between those who have goods and those who have needs? The market involves naming or defining with the money word over and over. This coat equals $20. This other coat equals $100. This bag of potatoes equals $4. The equation between products and money, which is a moment of the naming process, becomes an important moment for the society as a whole. It seems to be the gateway to all value. In fact, it is used to bring some products into the category of valuable, while others appear to be valueless because they are not saleable, or because they are free, gifts of nature, air, water, sunlight, etc. Masculation has made everyone expect to be elevated or fear being demoted by being put in one category instead of another. The moment of naming with a gender term, John is a boy, or with money, 1 pound of coffee equals $2, puts the person or the product in the category of those having value in relation to that word or to that amount of money. Girls and products which are unsaleable or free do not belong to the superior category. Thus, the gender term for females already attributes to the person the contradictory value of not being in the superior valued category. Being put in a superior category by is a boy seems to deprive the members of the category of their ability to give in the present, while giving them another mode with something else. Words, positions, money to strive for, a distraction and a kind of addiction. The naming of gender and the exchange of products for money focus us in the present, but only through the misrecognition of gifts and overemphasis on the equation and substitution. We give value to definitions rather than to people or to the nurturing way which remains concealed in the shadow. Gifts give value to the receiver. Exchange does not, except through the process of deserving, where the exchanger appears to cause the payment herself through her own value, her previous production, etc. As in masculation, where boys learn to deserve the name male, the definition takes over and the gift model gives way. The social gift, the name, takes over from individual gifts because it is general, appears to be something else to have arcane power. The one many position, when used as a privileged, phallically invested sample with power in the real world, backs up this fetishized power of the name. When we earn a professional qualification, we can call ourselves a journalist or a doctor. We enter a privileged category. By behaving in appropriate ways and learning to put into practice the knowledge we have mastered, we are able to fit the definition. Like the boy, we earn the right to bear the name, and we earn a living in the exchange economy. And I'm reading from Forgiving, A Feminist Critique of Exchange by Genevieve Vaughan. A self-replicating parasite on the tree of life. At a true meta level, we would recognize exchange as partial, just as we would recognize the male gender and its definition as partial. But gift-giving does not see itself, nor gift-givers, as its creatively receptive others. The meta level is confused by different kinds of self-similar reflections. Anything attributing importance mainly to itself is necessarily partial because it diminishes its other and decontextualizes itself, pulls itself out of its context, while the reflections of the concept structure make it appear to be all there is. Gifts require others who will receive them. But people in the closed system of the extreme hierarchical patriarchy attribute importance to themselves through the instrumentalization of those who are different or inferior. They use others for the purpose of enhancing themselves, while denying others' importance as the source of their good. This process gives these artificial egos completion, while making it seem as if they are self-made, either through being nurtured because they deserve it, or through manipulation or force, or because the other is inferior, or it is his, her, quote, nature or, quote, instinct or duty to give to one in that position. Of course she takes care of him. He's her husband. The male occupies the sample or one position, requiring others to relate to him as many, reinstating the moment of comparison and equivalence between relative items and the sample to the concept formation process. The many also give way and give to the one who takes over, repeating the many-to-one relation between things and their names. These patterns become self-confirming. The human one ignores the many and stands alone out of context, self-reflecting as one instance of one. The process repeats and reflects itself at different levels. Since recognition is based upon comparison and equivalence appear to be the all-important relations. However, the equation and the concept form only seem to constitute the whole meta-level. Instead, they are one branch of the fractal tree, the trunk of which is gift-giving. Perhaps we should say their structures are a vine, a parasite upon the tree. Reworking the metaphor, it's not just the trunk of the tree that has the structure of gift-giving. In fact, the possibility of giving and receiving elicit a living tree. The leaf receives sunlight, uses it in photosynthesis, sends its products throughout the tree to satisfy its needs for energy. The roots receive and transmit moisture from the rain and minerals from the earth and the humus of previous leaves and trees. The availability of the gifts of earth, water, air, and sunlight allow the development of living things which can receive these gifts. The decontextualized equation and the concept, classes, exchange, hierarchies, also derive the possibility for their existence from the gifts that are given to them through the roots they have planted in the gift way. They serve living beings who have warped and distorted themselves so they can receive these abstract gifts. The whole society creatively receives the altered nourishment. Patriarchal structures develop a culture of gift-giving because they too are able to receive in special ways and give again to beings who are adapted to receiving them. It has been made into a permanent condition of ego isolation, which serves the economy, the psychology, and all the institutions built upon masculation. Patriarchy maintains control through the supporting interplay of various decontextualized self-similar structures. The vine, the parasite, is the overdevelopment of the equation, the concept structure, classes. It is made up of human definitional strings organized into hierarchies, which suck up gifts to nurture the ones at the top. Patriarchy cannot exist on its own, but twines around the tree of human gift-giving and feeds on it, draining away the goods from needs, creating the scarcity, which serves as its necessary environment. The artificial parasite becomes believable and self-validates by reiterating its own form. Exchange, as it replaces one product with another, also continually replaces the need-oriented, qualitatively varied gift with a qualitatively simple, quantitatively varied equation. It asserts part of the concept process, the equation, as reality, while replacing the gift-giving female with the sample male. Qualitatively oriented gift-giving is replaced by a quantitative naming process, which has had its gift aspects canceled. This takeover is the acting out of masculation. The equation itself appears to be a gift, which also appears inalienable or perhaps inescapable. Actually, it creates a focus upon itself and receives importance from others through its reflection. And I'm reading from For Giving, A Feminist Critique of Exchange by Genevieve Vaughan. Being and Having. What we're seeing here is the psycho-socioeconomic meeting between being and having. In the relation between the word and the sample, the sample and its items, the father and the sons, and the owner and his properties, even the owner of the male body and his body parts. The masculated boy identifies with what he is by what he has, and by the similarity of what he has with what others have, rather than creating his identity in an ongoing way by what he gives and receives. Then he lets that relation be played out symbolically as he constructs his identity around other possessions, many of which are phallic symbols. Because the erect phallus is the possession of the adult male who is his model, the symbolic phallus, in toy cars and little guns, lets the boy privilege that having in the immature present. Exchange is made necessary by the mutually exclusive relation of private property. Property is a relation in which the many things give and give way to the one owner. This makes it similar to the relation between men as body part holders and women who are lacking but who give and give way to the one who has. Women internalize the desire for property and the mistrust of giving that come with the exchange paradigm. And this is also perhaps part of the reason that we do not propose the giving model for our sons. We push our sons away from giving and into the change of categories and likeness to their fathers, so that we can be sure that the boys will have the right kind of identity to get what they need and keep it. If they were to follow our model, they could presumably be considered sissies and excluded from heterosexual patriarchy, exiled in a no-man's land, where they would neither be male nor female. This strange mothering behavior occurs because gender is actually an economic identity. What we consider, quote, male, characteristics of competitiveness, aggression, sublimation of emotion, focus on goals rather than process, etc., are the qualities rewarded by capitalism. The reason for that is that capitalism is the economic way that is based on male gender characteristics. Capitalism is the replay at many levels of the exchange categories caused by the definition of gender and the denial of nurturing. And I'm reading from Forgiving by Genevieve Vaughn. Patriarchy denies and discredits gift-giving in order to preserve itself. The two paradigms remain consistent with themselves. Mothering appears as giving away the penis property and the boy and being deprived of both, but continuing to give. Gift-giving, therefore, seems self-sacrificing, even self-mutilating. Practitioners of the exchange paradigm appear to be giving up the mother but receiving the penis, the superior male identity, and the exchange model itself in exchange. The logic of exchange confirms itself, and the logic of gift-giving confirms the other. The castration, quote-unquote, of the mother is replayed when the buyer gives up the money and receives the reward of the nurturing goods he needs. Those who hoard and accumulate money do not undergo this symbolic castration, and in capitalism, find a way to increase the money almost infinitely. The market serves as a safe space in which to act out the childhood trauma of the boy's change of categories due to the naming of his gender. It has the healing effect of showing that giving up the product for sale, transferring it into the value category and the category of ownership by another, is not a harmful process in and of itself. Moreover, the symbolic castration involved in giving up the money is shown to be benign, not harmful to the buyer. Unfortunately, the whole process of exchange for money takes the place of gift-giving as a form of the life of the community. Then gift-givers give to the exchange process itself, valuing it above the very process they are practicing. In a context of scarcity, pockets of gift economy are dependent on gifts from some part of the exchange system. Women have traditionally given up everything in order to put themselves in a position to be able to receive these gifts. Now they have joined the exchange paradigm as its actors, using the money they earn to support and nurture their children. Even when the gift givers are working in the exchange economy themselves, they often have to give their children up to the definitions and models provided by schools, television, and the streets, while they sell their labor in order to support them. The mothering economic model is diminished again at the same time that women are representing it at another level, giving up their labor time in exchange for money for which to provide their children, and giving up their children to be educated by others in the exchange economy. Even though many mothers now engage in monetized labor, there is an expectation that gender roles will continue to be distinct. Television and film personages locate the father in the imagination. The programs which show us one many dominant men, from police chiefs to fathers, supermen to singers. Women stars also perform one many roles as sex objects, business women, super spies, even newscasters, as the one visible speaker to whom the many invisible listeners are related fit this pattern. The dominant submission model, combined with hierarchy and competition, are everywhere visible in our entertainment industry, business, politics, academia, continuing to offer the poisoned gift apple to Little Prince Charming, providing the pernicious patriarchal models which are no longer available in mother-centered families. Gang relations also sometimes personally supply the one-many violent paternal models which are missing from the families of single mothers, as what Alfred Sohn Rethel calls the social nexus, the deep pattern upon which society constructs itself. I think that in spite of the difficulties, mother-centered families are beginning to change this situation. All too often, however, the discrediting of the single mother, together with the lack of the father, leaves the boy vulnerable to other, more negative, masculated samples as he follows the maze of one many patterns that make up patriarchy. We are creating our reality collectively in a way which is harmful and unnecessary. By this, I do not mean that trees and cows, mountains and automobiles, children and grandmothers are not there. I mean that we have been living out a distorted process, masculation, taking the images it spawns of itself as the principles by which to organize our lives. The misinterpretation of who we are and what we ought to be doing results in the rewarding of having and the punishment of not having. Masculation creates a collective psychosis by which individual men vie with each other to be the sample man, and whole armies vie with each other to make their fatherland the sample nation. Overtaking is sometimes implemented violently in the family as the masculated gender role, or through the dominance of the adult over the child. Giving way seems to be the role of the woman or the child, who is obedient to the adult's words or commands. In the market, money takes over and the product gives way. At the same time, the exchange process takes over and gift-giving gives way. The market's definitions are many and short-lived. High speed compared with the long-term definitional positions of overtaking and giving way that are typical of the roles of command and obedience, for instance, in hierarchies of the government, the army, or the church. Though many short-term acts of overtaking and giving way and command and obedience may occur in these hierarchies, they flow together to make stable long-term roles. In the market, the position of the head honcho is only one, money, the general equivalent, while in human hierarchies there is a chain in which the ones above take over from those below, and those below give and give way to those above, to the ever more privileged ones. Even the Bible says, "To him that has, much shall be given." The intermediate moment between product and need, which is based on exchange and the equation, becomes the focus of the whole society, requiring equality with money for access to goods. The masculating definition overtakes nurturing and imposes itself as a model everywhere. We have distorted reality, distributing goods psychotically to the benefit of the few, to the point of almost omnipotence, according to a child's dream. We are using our linguistic ability to name or define, to transfer privilege onto some people instead of others, making them haves instead of have-nots. The priorities of masculation have altered reality collectively in a pernicious way. But if we understand, as Eastern religions have always said, that this reality is an illusion, a nightmare, we can return to a gift economy, the ever-present possibility of which is the true dream in which we can finally awake, recreating a reality which is a gift for all. And I've been reading from Forgiving, a Feminist Critique of Exchange by Genevieve Vaughn, originally published in 1997. You can download and read this entire book online for free and learn more about the idea of the gift economy at gift-economy.com. And you can download this and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests through our archive at unwelcomeguests.org. And I'd particularly like to appeal to those of you who do download the show online and do take the podcast. Please support the AInfos Radio Project that makes this possible, a completely volunteer mutual aid organization. Thank you for listening.